After the tumor panel discussion, I met with Dr. Moll to further discuss the issues that came up and other recent developments in prostate cancer clinical research, and he began by commenting on the value of PSA for screening.
We're now 15 years into the PSA era, and at the beginning of the PSA era, it was easy. We got the low-hanging fruit, all the guys with these big whopping PSAs, and it was real easy to diagnose prostate cancer. And as we move through the PSA era, it's gotten more difficult and more controversial. And then you listen to, for example, Dr. Tom Stamey, who's contributed a tremendous amount to our field and in PSA. But when he came out a year or two ago and basically said that PSA was no good, that set the field on edge. Well, the reality of it is PSA is still the best marker we've ever had for any type of cancer, much less prostate cancer, but it certainly isn't perfect, and we have to use it smarter as we move further and further into the PSA era. So with that background, what we did is see if the rate of change of PSA is more predictive of prostate cancer than PSA itself. Because most of these men that we see now know their PSA. Their primary care doctor, their internist, or even their urologist. I mean, they have a series of PSAs. And so can we look at that change to predict prostate cancer? And bottom line is that with a large data set, with varied ages of men, the rate of change of PSA with and without cancer is different for young men versus older men. So younger men, a lower slope of their PSA. They have lower rising PSA, but yet those subtle rises in young men are more predictive of prostate cancer because there isn't as much BPH, there isn't as much prostatitis, there isn't as much confounding stuff going on. And so we're finding that if you measure PSA starting at, say, age 40 through age 50 or age 40 through 59 in that 20-year lifespan of a man, that probably a delta of PSA or a change of PSA more than about a half a point per year is predictive of prostate cancer. And the reason that is important is 12 or 14 years ago, Bal Carter from Johns Hopkins was the first person to propose PSA velocity as a screening tool for prostate cancer. And Bal said that if a guy has a PSA going up more than about 0.75 points per year, that was a red flag for prostate cancer. And what we're finding is that Bal's data does hold for older men, but for younger men, men in their 40s and 50s, it's probably more appropriate to use a slightly lower cut point for PSA velocity, to the tune of about 0.4 to 0.6. And we're fine-tuning it right now to try to come up with something that's easy to remember so that the doctors in the trenches can use it.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about the PSA data that came out of the prostate cancer prevention trial. I've talked with Ian Thompson about this, kind of an interesting data set.
The prostate cancer prevention trial has taught us a lot already, and it'll probably continue to reap dividends for years to come because it's such a huge data set of over 18,000 patients. Well, first off, it's taught me that we can prevent prostate cancer. I'm kind of in the positive camp on the study, suggesting that finasteride is useful to prevent prostate cancer, and certainly from a public health standpoint, could make a huge impact. So that's one thing it's taught me. Number two, it kind of taught me that there's a pretty high rate of prostate cancer, even in that PSA range between 2.5 and 4. And it taught me that we probably need to use stuff like PSA velocity, or we need better biomarkers to fine-tune use of PSA in those lower levels.
You mentioned biomarkers. Anything on the horizon right now that'll help differentiate clinically significant prostate cancer from insignificant?
I won't say on the immediate horizon. That's the key question. Who has important prostate cancer and who has unimportant prostate cancer? And I don't know of anything that's immediate. But on the screening front, there are two things that I think in the biomarker field that are useful. Number one, and it's already FDA approved, is the UPM3 molecular urine test. Now, right now, it's only available through Bostwick's lab in Richmond as a urine-based assay where one sends an immediate post-prostate massage urine to their lab and they look for messenger RNA expression of this prostate-specific gene. And when that's negative, it has a pretty good negative predictive value that the guy does not have prostate cancer. The positive predictive value is about 75%, which is still better than PSA. And my understanding is that a number of other biotech companies are trying to use that technology, but to simplify the platform. So right now, you have to get that immediate post-massage urine. You have to put some buffer in there. It has to be shipped fairly quickly. And if you do all that stuff, the results are pretty accurate, but they're trying to simplify it, make it so that it could be done without having to add the buffer and maybe done on an easier platform. The other thing is proteomics, which our group has looked at and other groups have looked at. And the bottom line there is it's just taking a blood sample and a serum sample and running it through a high-tech black box, if you will, to look at the different protein patterns that are in that blood sample. And what we have found is that you can use that, and it's more accurate than PSA to tell if a guy has prostate cancer or doesn't have prostate cancer. Although right now it's expensive, it's not completely verified as far as the technology, and it doesn't replace PSA in the screening setting. We also looked at it to see if those protein patterns would help predict prognosis, help us tell who has the good cancer and the bad cancer. And so far, it's been a little bit frustrating because you get so much data out of this blood sample, all these different proteins, and maybe several hundred proteins with different peaks, and it takes incredibly sophisticated statistics and biostatistics to sort that out. We were collaborating with the National Cancer Institute, and even with that high-powered biostatistical unit, so far in our first pass efforts, we weren't able to get proteomics to really, for example, predict PSA recurrence in men who had been through a radical prostatectomy or predict some of the stuff that we can measure.
Another PSA issue that you did a lot of great work on with the military was the issue of PSA progression. Can you summarize where we are in general with that and what you're planning at Duke?
PSA recurrence or PSA progression continues to be a hot topic, controversial topic. From a clinical standpoint, for the average urologist in the trenches, the $64,000 question is when they have a guy who has a rising PSA after surgery or radiation, when do you pull the trigger on hormones? And that remains controversial. I think that our data that we published in 2004 said, well, high-risk men, men who have a rapid PSA doubling time, men who had higher Gleason scores in their radical, those men, you certainly can't be criticized by starting hormonal therapy early because they're not going to do well otherwise with watchful waiting. More recently, Steve Friedland, who just recently came to Duke, published a nice paper in JAMA in July of 2005 where he looked at the Johns Hopkins data set, and it's a follow-on on the Pound paper from 1999. Bottom line is that Steve created a nomogram that looked at 10-year mortality after PSA recurrence. So in other words, all these guys who had a biochemical recurrence after surgery, and then said, okay, what's the chance of a guy dying of prostate cancer 10 years later? And found that PSA doubling time, Gleason score, and when the PSA recurrence happened, whether it was earlier than 3 years or later than 3 years after the surgery, those three factors were a pretty good predictor of death from prostate cancer, and he created a nomogram. So if you're in the bad boxes on this nomogram where factors are all not in a man's favor, the good news is we can predict who's going to die of prostate cancer. The bad news is that we're still not sure if we put those bad patients on hormonal therapy if we're going to change the natural history. Combining Steve's Hopkins paper with our paper from the military would suggest that it's very reasonable to use hormonal therapy in those high-risk PSA recurrences, but we need a randomized trial, which we don't have, to address the question.
Another thing that we generally try to factor in, but I don't know that we can do this numerically, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the patient's age, comorbidities, and threat of other illness. In breast and colon cancer, we have models such as Peter Ravden's adjuvant model, where he factors in competing causes of mortality. Do we have anything like that in prostate cancer, or is it more seat of the pants?
That's a great point, great question. We don't have it, and we need it. It would be particularly, I think, useful for some of the high-risk radiation failures, because those men tend to be a little older with more competing morbidities. With surgery patients, it's going to be a little more of a challenge, at least in the United States, because the urologists already select out the healthier, younger men for surgery. So even when a man is, say, 5 years out from surgery and has a biochemical recurrence, for the most part, he's still fairly young and still has fairly low comorbid conditions. So it's going to be a challenge. Nevertheless, it needs to be done. No one, to my knowledge, has really done any job with that, and that's definitely needed.
You mentioned the issue of robotics, and I know when you were first heading out towards Duke, you were curious about sort of what the real world, so to speak, was like. And I'm curious now, a year and a half later, what it is like and how issues like robotics are factoring into your life.
Robotic prostatectomy is one of the most controversial areas in urologic oncology right now for the average urologist. To set the stage, the robotic prostatectomy came on the scene about 3 years ago, and certainly from a marketing standpoint, it's really caught on. Every hospital almost feels like they have to have the robot to keep up with the Joneses as far as the hospital down the street. Nevertheless, the outcome comparisons between robotic prostatectomy and what I still consider the gold standard open radical prostatectomy through a small, low, midline incision, the outcomes have not been demonstrated to be any better with the robotic. In fact, there really are no good outcome studies that really have compulsively looked at it. We're desperately trying to do this at Duke. It's not a randomized study. However, we're really trying to get all the patients who get either type of surgery to fill out really good quality of life instruments before the surgery and then periodically in the first 2 years. So far, we're not demonstrating any statistically significant benefits in the robot, except that there is a lower blood loss, but not a difference in transfusion rates. And there does seem to be, for those men who have a very strenuous physical labor type job, there might be about a 5 to 7 day improvement in those men being able to go back to full activity. Other than that, we haven't proven the difference in potency rates. We haven't proven a difference in continence rates. We haven't shown a difference in hospital stay. We've definitely shown a difference in cost. It's a tremendously more expensive procedure for our country and our healthcare system, the disposables associated with it. The OR time alone, even in the best of hands, adds about an hour to an hour and a half over an open prostatectomy. At Duke, the average time for an open radical prostatectomy is an hour and a half to 2 hours. The average time, including docking time, for a robotic prostatectomy is running about 3.5 to 4 hours. So just that time factor is going to be an impact for us as a society with limited OR utilization, limited OR availability. North Carolina, for example, is a CON state, a certificate of need state. So we're limited in the number of new operating rooms we can build with the aging population, increasing need for health resources. In our state, we have a shortage of OR rooms. And when you tie an OR room up for an additional time like that, it makes a difference. For example, we're able to do 2 robotic cases at Duke in a surgeon's 12-hour given block of time, whereas we can do 3 and then sometimes 4 retropubic or perineal prostatectomies in that same block of time. And it becomes particularly challenging for a Medicare patient where the reimbursements from the government are fixed and the cost to do the procedure is greater for both the healthcare team, the surgeons, as well as the hospital.
You know, I was just thinking, I think the last time I saw you actually was the roundtable that we did with physicians who had prostate cancer, rad oncs and urologists and med oncs. I would guess that it's not uncommon for patients to ask you, if you had to have a prostatectomy, what kind would you prefer? How do you answer that?
It's interesting. I answered that question about 10 minutes ago on my cell phone coming to this meeting because an old Army buddy contacted me whose father had prostate cancer, and he was contemplating between the two. 73-year-old man, Medicare patient, and he has several choices. He's been on the internet, he's heard the hype, he seems to be interested in a robotic prostatectomy. But the reality of it is, if he wants a robotic prostatectomy in the Southeast and wants it to be covered by Medicare, the wait time is going to be probably July, August, September time frame.
4 or 5 months.
Right. If he wants to go to a surgeon who has already opted out of insurance, who only accepts cash, he can certainly get the operation done much more quickly.
What would that cost?
Anywhere from probably surgeon's fees ranging from $9,000 to $20,000, depending on where he goes. And certainly some institutions are doing that. And so for a patient who wants a quick operation by an expert surgeon, he may have to pay out of pocket or wait.
What's the total fee?
For example, at our institution, if it's an international patient paying cash, the upfront hospital charge is $25,000 and the upfront surgeon charge is $10,000. So it's a total $35,000 out of pocket. Now, if the patient gets released from the hospital on post-op day one, they typically will get about a half of the hospital fee rebated to them. So typically a patient may have about a $10,000 hospitalization and a $10,000 surgeon's fee for a total fee of about $20,000. But if the patient has complications and ends up staying in the hospital 3 days, for example, then it would cost $35,000 roughly. So that's a big chunk of money for many patients, and we're starting to see that in that some of the surgeons who have the largest experience levels in this country have decided to opt out, and to some extent it is creating a two-tiered system. I'm not going to editorialize whether that's right or wrong, but that is becoming a fact, not only with the robotic prostatectomy, but with the open prostatectomy as well.
So what did you suggest to your Army buddy?
I told him my approach is not to pick it based on the machine, pick it based on the person. Too many hospitals, I think, are marketing the machine, where in my opinion, they should be marketing the people, because data has shown that it's not so much whether you do it robotically or open, it's the skill set of the individual surgeon, the care he or she does in performing the operation, and their experience level. Peter Scardino has shown that in the Memorial Sloan Kettering database. If I'm not mistaken, Cleveland Clinic has also shown that. And the challenge we face right now is many surgeons are still in the learning curve with a robotic prostatectomy. Jay Smith, who's a noted authority on both open and robotic prostatectomy at Vanderbilt University, has recently said he believes it takes about 250 cases to overcome the learning curve when switching from the open surgery to the robotic surgery. So if that's true, then the first 250 patients in any surgeon's experience may not have the same chance for excellence as the patients who were treated by the more traditional route before that. Now, granted, some surgeons are going to be quicker studies than others, and I'm sure the learning curve is not going to be universally 250 cases, but I think that points out, and again, Jay Smith is an outstanding open surgeon. His bar is high. He knows what it takes to get the subtle improved outcomes related to continence. He knows what it takes to get the subtle improved outcomes with nerve sparing. And so if you really set the bar high where you should, it probably does take a large number of cases to get to that level of excellence that patients expect. Also, I told this man to ask his local doctor how many cases he has performed. And he said, well, but won't the doctor get mad at me? And I said, well, yes, but you should not care about that. You need to pin the surgeon down. How many cases have you done in your career? How many cases do you do per year? What are your own individual complications rates? And the challenges we face is that most people quote, for example, the Hopkins data. Most people will quote what's in the literature, not what their own individual statistics are.
I'm curious about your take on the developments in the last couple of years in terms of chemotherapy for prostate cancer and where you see that heading.
Well, the good news, bad news. I was very gratified to see that docetaxel got FDA approved as first modern chemotherapy or the first chemotherapy period to increase survival with men with hormone refractory prostate cancer. So I was really happy about that. But also, as a urologist, I was frustrated because the delta improvement in survival was only a matter of a few months. And so it pointed out there's clearly a lot of room for improvement.
What have you observed in terms of patients that are going to an oncologist to receive docetaxel-based regimens in terms of how they seem to tolerate it?
Well, I've been very impressed that most patients tolerate it very well. Of course, I'm a little bit maybe out of the loop in this regard in that I work at an academic center and have a world-class prostate-oriented medical oncologist who is one of my colleagues. And so I have great service and we get great interactions and exchange the hormone refractory prostate cancer patients easily between me and him and works out great. I would say in the community setting, I'm not certain how it's going. I hear frustration among the community urologists saying that, oh, it's only a few months survival advantage. That's not a big deal. Why should I refer those patients? I hear similar frustrations by the medical oncologist saying we want to treat prostate cancer, yet we're still not getting those patients in a timely fashion. They're still very far advanced by the time we get them. And then also we hear our professional societies, ASCO primarily and AUA/Society of Urologic Oncology, there seems to be a little bit of angst in that even though we're all being taught that multidisciplinary therapy and working between the medical oncologist and the urologist and the radiation oncologist is a way to go, and I do believe that, there is some threat that the urologist may be afraid that they might potentially, quote unquote, lose prostate cancer to medical oncology, which could potentially turn into a turf battle. Now, I hope it doesn't, and I think that both specialties clearly need to be involved. But urologists and urologic professional societies clearly do not want to lose prostate cancer. We as urologists feel that we are the primary care physicians, if you will, for men with prostate cancer. Squarely, the management of those prostate cancer patients must remain in our domain, and we need to stay involved.
Do you think there's a role for the use of chemotherapy or Taxotere in patients who have PSA-only disease who also are hormone refractory?
Honestly, I don't know. I think that that's one of the hot topics, you know, PSA-only hormone refractory prostate cancer, where PSA era, these guys with PSA recurrence, they got put on hormones, they had a negative bone scan, and then they have a rising PSA and still have a negative bone scan. And in fact, I'm trying to relook at that in our database. When I was at Walter Reed, we did a first pass effort looking at the natural history of that. And the bottom line, even though we only published in an abstract form, was that those men have a much longer survival than the traditional guy with hormone refractory prostate cancer, to the tune of about 5 year survival for that man versus 2 to 3 years for the man with more traditional hormone refractory.
I.e. metastatic disease?
Yes. And again, that was basically looking in the Department of Defense, Center for Prostate Disease Research, military prostate database, which included about a dozen hospitals. And we looked at that. And like I said, we're still trying to get that published because it's a good data set. But I think it points out that any clinical trials we do, there is going to be a longer natural history of that. It's going to take longer to get the mortality endpoint. And I could potentially see some uncertainty in some of those trials. Let's just use the example of a vaccine trial for prostate cancer. Let's say a company does a vaccine trial in that disease state of PSA-only hormone refractory prostate cancer. And let's say it's a phase 2 non-randomized trial because they want to do that to get interest in their shareholders, and they report a median survival of, say, 40 months, just as an example, or 48 months. Well, that sounds great, but unless we get good quality natural history data out there, I was showing that those guys live 5 years on average anyway with routine care because they're migrated backwards and there's a bigger lead time.
I guess the other part of the equation is what's the side effects and tolerability of the therapy. And traditionally, chemotherapy doesn't have, quote, the greatest name in the world. But specifically as it relates to Taxotere-based therapy, how do you see your patients tolerating it in terms of just daily side effects, and what stories do they tell?
I can give you a specific example. 2 weeks ago, I did a radical prostatectomy on a 42-year-old man who 6 months before that was told that he had stage C prostate cancer. He had a CAT scan and an MRI, which showed, I think it was Gleason 7, but he had supposedly extension into the bladder base and into the apex on both of these imaging studies. And the guy was only 42 years old. Now, I didn't see him at that time, so I don't know exactly what his digital rectal exam was, but let's say he had stage C disease. They treated him with 4 cycles of docetaxel plus LHRH, and I saw him about 7 days only after he completed the 4th cycle. And his performance status was 100%. If he hadn't have told me, I would have never known he was on chemotherapy.
He had his hair?
Yes. And again, he was a relatively healthy, strapping 42-year-old guy. And I did his radical prostatectomy, and at least anecdotally, the case went very smoothly. We didn't encounter any significant problems, and he was discharged on post-op day one.
That's an interesting story in terms of tolerability. I guess we should throw in the caveat that that approach to therapy would be pretty unproven.
Right. I was actually kind of surprised when he came to see me. He was referred to me specifically for post-chemotherapy, hormone therapy, radical prostatectomy. I was actually surprised how aggressive they were, in that obviously there's no randomized controlled trial that would support the way he was treated. Even for hormonal therapy in that setting, it's gotten more controversial because the randomized trials have not been definitive. But nevertheless, I think he got a good treatment. Nevertheless, it's not proven. And my gut tells me that that aggressive approach pre-op probably will translate into a better outcome for that man. Even though, again, putting my academic hat on, there was absolutely no evidence basis currently to say that what he had was the right thing to do.
I would guess if we did a survey of clinical investigators, I would say in urology and medical oncology, and we can throw in radiation oncology in terms of what their thoughts are about neoadjuvant chemotherapy, it would be a pretty negative response off protocol.
In fairness, to go back to this case, now dissecting it, there are a couple factors that perhaps we could also argue were errors in this case. Number one, his local clinicians relied heavily on the MRI result. And to say that he had locally extensive disease, and I think all of us know that the MRI can be very misleading, he may or may not have had stage C disease based on the MRI. Number two, because he was only 42 years old, many clinicians in the trenches mistakenly believe that, oh, young patients got to have more aggressive disease.
Right.
When in fact, in the PSA era, we know that young age does not signify necessarily worse disease. So young age alone is not a poor prognostic factor. So we could argue it in the reverse, that they overtreated him thinking that just because he was young, he was going to have bad disease, and maybe overinterpreted the MRI.
What did you see at surgery and pathologically?
Well, it's interesting. I don't have the pathology report back yet, so I don't know, because it was just recently done within the last week. But clinically, at the time of surgery, I didn't really feel anything that was suspicious. The lymph nodes were negative. And in fact, there was nothing that, to me, suggested extracapsular extension.
Chemo's good stuff, huh?
Either chemo's good stuff, or they really, you know, went out on a limb and treated this guy when he had localized disease.
Right. Well, let me know what the pathology showed. Can you talk a little bit about where we are in terms of cryotherapy?
We're now in the fourth generation of cryotherapy. Cryotherapy was done in the 60s, basically with one probe stuck in the prostate with an open incision. It progressed, and then in the 80s, it was five larger probes where they pumped liquid nitrogen in, but it was still a gigantic Zamboni machine in the operating room, so it was a little bit unwieldy. Now, with the fourth generation, it's very small probes using a brachytherapy template. The probes use argon gas, so it's not a liquid. And in the current studies that are out there, it does appear to be safer. In other words, current generation cryotherapy does seem to be associated with less incontinence, because they can control the ice ball better. There's less unwieldy ice balls outside the prostate that cause incontinence. They use thermocouple sensors to measure the ice ball and the temperature, so that part is good. The big problem with cryotherapy that is their challenge is that most of these guys now with localized prostate cancer are young, healthy, and are potent. And if you do cryotherapy properly and create an entire ice ball in the prostate that freezes outside the capsule of the prostate, most of the men are impotent. So they've had trouble making it popular for the bulk of the patients that we're seeing today. So the latest buzz is focal cryotherapy, to try to, say, only treat the one side of the prostate so they can avoid injuring the nerve on the other side. It potentially makes sense if we had a good way to tell where the prostate cancer was in the prostate. But right now, there's no good imaging method to say where the prostate cancer actually is. And even doing extended core biopsies may miss cancer on the opposite side. So it's still considered very experimental or investigational to do focal cryotherapy. The other new technology is something called HIFU, or high-intensity focused ultrasound. And that's been used in Europe for the last 5 to 7 years and does seem to show promise, although the big controversy there is whether this energy, this heat energy in the prostate, actually eradicates all the prostate cancer. Nevertheless, there are at least two companies that are bringing the technology to the United States and have FDA approval to start testing high-intensity focused ultrasound and clinically localized prostate cancer. I know at our university, we're going to be starting a phase 1-2 trial to look at this technology in localized prostate cancer.
What about screening and diagnosis? Anything new there?
We talked about the age adjusting, the PSA velocity, which was the number one abstract on for the ASCO-ASTRO-SUO meeting in San Francisco in February. So that was a hot topic. The other hot topic that was presented at that meeting was this issue of the virus etiology for prostate cancer. The group at Cleveland Clinic, who collaborated with a number of other institutions, and it was actually presented by Dr. Eric Klein, are showing that a certain group of men who have some genetic polymorphism, but that genetic polymorphism only maybe affects 20 to 25% of guys with prostate cancer. But if they have that predisposition, then they've discovered a virus that seems to associate with prostate cancer. Now, they haven't obviously proven Koch's postulates by any stretch of the imagination, but that was another hot paper suggesting that there could, it's certainly very appealing. I mean, it would make a lot of sense if there was a viral etiology of prostate cancer, just like there is with cervical cancer. People want to believe that. It's easy to understand. So it got a lot of attention at the meeting. Whether it actually pans out is anybody's guess. But there's a lot more interest in inflammation, and is inflammation slash infection related to prostate cancer?
What are some of the common questions that you get from urologists in community practice?
I get a lot of questions about the screening debate, and urologists aren't right on the front end of screening. They're typically getting the guys who've already had an elevated PSA, and I think one of the biggest issues for urologists is what to do with the guy who has a persistently elevated PSA and has been through three or four sets of biopsies. There's a lot of questions about that. How much do you still rely on PSA? How many sets of biopsies do you do? What's the role of this new UPM3 molecular urine test, where people are advocating after a certain number of biopsies, you go to that molecular test, and if that's positive, do more biopsies, but if it's negative, you leave the patient alone. People want to know about proteomics and other things to help them in that setting. People want to know if they should do 12 core biopsies or crank it up to 42 biopsies in those cases. So that's a hot topic among urologists as far as the screening or early detection thing. Then we talked about robotic prostatectomy. Certainly in urologists' mind, as surgeons, that's the big debate. What's better, robotic versus more traditional? Talked about the fact that it probably is more important to pick the right surgeon as opposed to the right machine. In PSA recurrence, again, they're still interested in knowing when to pull the trigger for hormone therapy when a patient has a rising PSA, and it's very controversial. As far as radiation therapy, one of the questions that comes up is, okay, I've sent the guy to radiation oncology. He's going to get external beam radiation. How long do I continue the hormone therapy? Because we have these conflicting randomized trials. Do I do it for 6 months? Do I do it for 12 months? Do I do it for 3 years? And now with younger, healthier patients who are less willing to accept some of the side effects, it's that balance of saying, well, you might be better off with 3 years of hormone therapy, like the BOLA trial suggested, but you might have patients who just are unwilling to accept the side effects of traditional hormonal therapy for 3 years.